The title of this evening's talk is called Rediscovering God. And there's an actual word for that, which I only discovered myself recently. It's called anatheism. Everyone knows what theism is, it's belief in God. Everyone knows what atheism is, it's disbelief in God. Anatheism is returning to God or going back to God. And this is something that many people do as part of a personal journey. It's something that I myself have done, as I'll say in a moment. It's also becoming a kind of social movement. And the interesting thing is, you see, that about 30, 40, 50 years ago, it was assumed by most educated people and intellectuals that religion would just fade away. You know, the communists in Russia, the Bolshevik Revolution, just assumed that the whole of religion would fade away within a couple of generations. There'd just be a few old women left in crumbling churches. And the general assumption has been among intellectuals that religion's a thing of the past, science and reason are what lead us onwards into the future. I used to believe that myself. But religion hasn't gone away. It's partly come back in fairly noxious fundamentalist forms, which have got a lot of people scared, and probably rightly so. But it's also coming back in intellectual life. Even atheists are now recognizing that religion's here to stay. So one of the things they've been exercising themselves about recently is trying to explain how it got to be there. They like to think that it's somehow hardwired into human brains. These illusions that people except them seem to need are hardwired into human brains, and they speculate as to how this could have got there through Darwinian natural selection. The atheist philosopher Daniel Dennett, for example, has speculated that a gene for credulity has been built into all of us through natural selection, because people who are more credulous would believe the mumbo-jumbo of shamans and witch doctors, and because they believed this mumbo-jumbo, they'd get better from diseases by the placebo effect. And therefore, there'd be natural selection for credulity genes. Not a terribly plausible theory, in my opinion, but the fact that atheist philosophers are now desperately trying to explain why this is the case is interesting. It's also an interesting movement going on in Britain and America of a kind of growth of an atheist religion. One of Britain's leading atheist philosophers, Alain de Botton, wrote a book a couple of years ago which was a bestseller in Britain and in the United States called Religion for Atheists. And Alain de Botton starts off by saying, I was raised atheist. His father was a Jewish banker in Zurich. He said, I was raised atheist. I took it for granted that there was no God. My parents treated anyone who showed the slightest interest in religion as if they were suffering from a terminal degenerative disease. And he said, I just take it for granted there's no God. But I'm talking about atheism 2.0. He said, I'm not interested in arguing against God. I'm interested in seeing what happens if you get rid of God. And in his book, it's rather interesting. He shows the ways in which people's lives are in fact impoverished through the lack of religion. Nowhere to gather and sing together on Sundays. Instead of having sermons, which he points out are talks designed to help you lead a better life, you just have lectures which give factual content with no guidance at all. And so instead of having models of virtue, there are no models of virtue. So he has this rather bleak picture of the secular world, and he's now trying to lead a movement to reinstate religion for atheists. He's funding an atheist temple in London. They've started a series of churches called the Sunday Assembly, atheist churches. And in London, he started the Sunday Sermon. The thing is, I'm not sure how well that will do. Regular sermons are only about 10 minutes long, and they're embedded in the middle of a service full of singing and other things that actually engage the attention. If you go to an atheist Sunday sermon, all you get is a one-hour-long sermon. This is a movement that's going on at the moment, and it's arousing a lot of discussion and debate within Britain. And it's part of this general tendency of rediscovering God. What I want to do first is say something about my own personal path. Then I'm going to talk about how we got to this situation today, what the key difference between atheism and theism is, and how we can move forward into a new way of understanding divine consciousness. One of the points about anatheism is that going back to God in the modern world involves doing so both in the context of atheism, learning from atheism, because it's a purifying movement that's done a lot to purify a lot of rubbish out of religions, but also any movement back to God has to take into account that there are so many different religious traditions. It's not going to be possible to have a kind of tunnel vision about any particular one. My own journey is I was raised in a Methodist family in a small town in England. I went to an Anglican boarding school, so I had a fairly conventional religious Christian upbringing. But as part of my scientific education, I quickly realized that my science teachers, most of them, were atheists, and that they regarded atheism as the normal position to have if you're a scientist. It's just part of the standard scientific worldview. Science and atheism go together. That was their view. I wanted to be a scientist, so it was part of a package deal, which I simply accepted. I was the only boy in my year at school who refused to get confirmed at the age of 14. And when I went to Cambridge as an undergraduate, I eagerly joined the Cambridge Humanist Association, the atheist organization for undergraduates. However, after going to a few meetings, I began to find it all a bit dull. The meeting that sticks in my mind most of all is when we were addressed by the great biologist Sir Julian Huxley, who was a leading humanist and atheist in Britain. And he was speaking to us about the importance of humans taking control of the evolutionary process and improving the human race. Now, negative eugenics was out of fashion by then as a result of the excesses of Nazi breeding policies in the Second World War. But positive eugenics was still fashionable among humanists like Huxley. And his answer for the improvement of the human race was the fathering of a new breed of super children who'd be fathered using fairly simple technology, sperm donation, and he enumerated the qualities which the sperm donors of the present age should have in order to create this uplift in humanity. And it turned out the ideal sperm donor was someone who came from a long scientific lineage, who had great academic achievements in biology or other sciences, who came from a distinguished family, who had good health, who was highly esteemed in public life, etc. In other words, the ideal sperm donor turned out to be Sir Julian himself. I forgot this incident, which happened when I was a second-year undergraduate, for a long time, until a couple of years ago we were visiting a friend of ours, Francis Huxley, the son of Sir Julian, who's now in his 80s. He's living in California. He's now 90, and he's living in California. And soon before we arrived, he'd had a series of letters from people in England saying they had reason to believe they might be his half-brothers or half-sisters, and could they have DNA swabs for a DNA test, because they thought that they'd been conceived by artificial insemination from a special sperm donor bank that had been set up in Britain, etc. Francis refused to give swabs. The last thing he wanted to do when he was 90, to have hundreds of half-sisters and half-brothers showing up as part of his father's eugenic project. Anyway, it all seemed a bit thin. And although I wanted to believe the universe was nothing but machinery and there was no God and no consciousness and it was just blind chance that had given rise to everything, I found it a strain. It was particularly a strain when I fell in love, and I was at the time I was in love, I had this lovely girlfriend. I was trying to come to terms with these emotions, and I was going to physiology lectures where we had a series on steroid hormones. And I learned the chemical formulae of testosterone and progesterone and estrogen and so on, and learned about how these affected different parts of the brain. I learned about the nerve impulses. But somehow it seemed to leave something out. And I began to feel that just wasn't enough. And then in the biochemistry department at Cambridge, I saw a big wall poster of human metabolic reactions, all the different arrows of the chemical reactions inside our bodies. And someone had written across the top in big blue letters, "Know thyself." And again, the gap between this list of chemicals and chemical reactions and the experience of being alive just seemed unbridgeably huge. I began to feel that something was wrong with mechanistic science, and I began to look at more holistic ideas. But I started with the ideas of Goethe, the German poet and botanist, and got more and more interested in a more holistic approach to science. But I was still an atheist at this stage, and I was really trying to find a better way forward for science, a more inclusive, holistic way of understanding life. In 1968, I had a scholarship from the Royal Society to go and study tropical plants in Malaya, at the University of Malaya. And on the way there, sponsored by the Royal Society, I travelled through India. India in 1968 was a very exciting place to be. And as I travelled through India, I encountered gurus and ashrams and temples and pilgrimages. And it opened my eyes to range of phenomena I was completely unfamiliar with. When I got back to England, I got interested in exploring consciousness. Psychedelics were around at the time, and so after I had various psychedelic experiences, which convinced me that the mind was vastly greater than anything I'd been told about in my scientific education. It just didn't seem to map onto these experiences. Then I got interested in transcendental meditation because I wanted to be able to explore consciousness without drugs, or as well as with drugs. So that was very convincing. In around 1970, the way they put this across in the Transcendental Meditation Center in Cambridge was, you don't need to believe anything, because they knew that most young people were allergic to the idea of God. So no idea of God or saints or beliefs. It's just physiological. You do this, it lowers the lactic acid levels in the blood, it stimulates the brain in the right position of places to create relaxation. It was portrayed as a purely a physiological way of achieving well-being and calmness. Well, that was fine by me. It worked. I enjoyed doing it, and I didn't need to believe in anything beyond my own brain. I was intrigued by India and by yoga and by meditation. And in 1974, I had a chance to go and work in India as the principal plant physiologist at the International Crops Research Institute in Hyderabad. And I was thrilled by the idea of immersing myself in this exotic and fascinating culture. When I was in India, I visited temples, ashrams, I went to discourses by gurus, and I had a number of adventures, some of them bizarre. I mean, some aspects of Hinduism are deeply profound. Other aspects are simply bizarre. And one example, this has actually got into a book. I told this story soon afterwards in London to somebody who told it to an Indian writer called Gita Mehta, and she put this in her book, Karma Kola. I was visiting this guru who was supposed to be a miracle worker, and he was famous for causing messages to float from the ceiling. You'd be sitting there and sheets of paper would float down from the ceiling with profound messages on them. So I went to see him hoping to get a profound message float down. But because I was a foreign scientist, he decided I needed something more special than just a message, which was the odor of sanctity. Now, there's a tradition in many cultures that holy men have a sweet smell, the odor of sanctity. And so he said to me, I am having the odor of sanctity. And so I said, oh, yes. And he said, I will show. You come with me. And he said, come. So he took me and I followed him. And he led me into a lavatory. And so there was this toilet. And he locked the door. And I found myself in this lavatory with a famous guru in his orange robes. And he said, my urine will turn to rose water. So he got out a mug. He got it off a shelf. And he says, you watch. And I thought I should avert my eyes, but no, he insisted. So I watched him pee into this metal tumbler, and then he gave it to me. He said, it is for you. So I said, well, let's go back to... So we went back to the room, and I described what had happened to people there, and the trouble is my sceptical mind was racing through. I hadn't seen the mug before he peed into it. Had he put concentrated rose water into it before he peed, etc.? It did smell of roses. Everybody there was amazed by this. They said, this is a very great blessing. So I said, well, it's such a great blessing, I feel I must share it. So... I was able to get away with only the tiniest sip, since everybody there was... these are adventures in search of, the spirit and stuff. I had many adventures in it, and I don't have time to relate any more, but this was... It was a period of extraordinary... it was very, very fascinating. I then took up Sufism. I had a Sufi teacher in Hyderabad who was the grandfather of a friend of mine who was a Sufi saint. He taught in Germany part of the time and part of the time in India. And he and I became great friends. He gave me a Sufi mantra, a wazifa, which I, for about a year, did the Sufi form of meditation. And one thing I learned from him was that in the Islamic tradition, particularly the Sufi tradition, pleasure, worldly pleasure, is considered God-given. It wasn't puritanical or ascetic. He wore wonderful brocade robes. He wore perfume. He's sat there running his hands, fingers through a bowl of jasmine blossom. He recited exquisite poetry. And this was because God gives these gifts. And it was a very big lesson for me, because I'd always associated religion with a kind of asceticism. But that's not the case in the Sufi world. But I didn't want to become a Sufi, because in India, to become a Sufi, you're a Muslim first and foremost, and fasting in Ramadan and that kind of thing I thought would be going a bit too far. Fortunately, I was circumcised already, so that wasn't an issue. But but I thought the arrest would be too much of a stretch. And then an original thought crossed my mind. What about the Christian tradition? And hadn't given it a thought. And I spoke to a Hindu guru, and he asked him about this, and he said, all paths lead to God. You come from a Christian family, so you should follow a Christian path. And I said, well, I had never thought of that. And he said, but I found it very convincing. And the more I thought about it, the more sense it made, because among my Indian friends, the big aim of doing these forms of meditation is to get free of the wheels of incarnation. The world, according to the Hindu cosmology, is getting steadily worse. We're in Kali Yuga. We're heading towards the end of an age. And everyone's trapped in cycles of rebirth. It's not a good thing to be reborn, reincarnated. It's a bad thing, because you want to get off this hopeless world, which is headed to destruction. So what you're doing in a spiritual life is undergoing a kind of vertical takeoff, leaving the rest of the world spinning on pointlessly, and you're just getting off. I just couldn't get that as the principal aim, and I realized I actually cared about... I was working to help poor farmers. It was some of my Indian colleagues at work, after work, would ask me, why do you do this? And I said, to help poor people who haven't got any. He said, that is not your business. That is their karma. He said, your business is to lead your own life to achieve liberation. But the idea that you should help other people is so deeply ingrained into Judeo-Christian tradition and the Islamic tradition. It's not just about individual salvation, it's about collective change. And I realized I was far more Christian than I'd ever imagined. I started going to church, to the Church of South India, the Anglican Church in Secunderabad, and after a while I got confirmed at the age of 34 by an Indian bishop. And I felt very happy to be relocated in a Christian tradition. But I still felt a huge tension between the Hindu wisdom, which I felt was so deep, and the Christian tradition, which seemed a bit shallow on the spirituality side. When I discovered this wonderful teacher, Father Bede Griffiths, who had a Christian ashram in South India. He was an English Benedictine monk who'd lived there for 25 years when I met him in India. And in his ashram, it combined many aspects of Indian culture with Christian tradition. The mass in the morning started with the Gayatri Mantra, which is that wonderful mantra invoking the sun. I said to Father Bede, how can you have a Hindu mantra in a Catholic ashram? And he said, precisely because it's Catholic. He said, Catholic means universal. If it excludes anything, it's not Catholic. He said, it's just a sect. And I really liked that approach. And I found this extraordinarily broad approach really helpful. And he became my main teacher. And I wrote my first book in his ashram, A New Science of Life. When I got back to England after a long period in India, I had a wonderful time rediscovering the Christian tradition. I love the fact Indians have pilgrimages. Europeans have pilgrimages. There's Santiago de Compostela's, the pilgrimage to Canterbury, the pilgrimage to Walsingham in England. So I rediscovered sacred places. England's full of them, great cathedrals, churches, stone circles, pre-Christian and Christian. And so I started visiting our native places. I started going to cathedrals where there's marvelous singing and these beautiful buildings resonating. And instead of just seeing it as an aesthetic experience, as I had done before, I now felt part of it and I was very, very moved by it and felt privileged to be part of this tradition. So since then, it's been my practice to go to church on Sundays whenever I can. The only place I can't is Cortes Island, because Christianity is almost extinct on Cortes Island. There is one church left at Cortes Bay, but it never functions in the summer when I'm here. So there's two Zendos, there's kirtan chanting. Until recently, there was a Peruvian ayahuascaro. There's a Tibetan Buddhist center. The Jewish ceremonies happen here, bar mitzvahs, bat mitzvahs. Yes, but if you want to go to a Christian service, it's virtually impossible. So here is the one time I can't do this, but I normally that's part of my practice wherever I am. What I want to do now, just so this is my own personal background, but what I want to do is look at the key issues as I see them as a result of going through this path and thinking about these things. The key difference, it seems to me, between an atheist and a theist or religious worldview is to do with the nature of consciousness. That is the complete key on which it all hinges. An atheist world, like a theist world, is one that's rationally ordered. Most atheists are materialists. They believe in the materialist philosophy of nature. Nature's governed by universal laws. Most materialists believe they were all there at the moment of the Big Bang. Timeless laws, principles of reason or order. That the whole of the universe is bound together by a universal energy. All energy can be interconverted. The whole universe has a unified source of energy. The whole universe is one unified being. That's why it's called a universe. Everything holds together. All of these are things that are part of traditional religious worldviews, and in the 17th century they were built into science on the basis of a kind of scientific theology. But the big difference is that for an atheist, the whole of this universe is unconscious. It's unconscious machinery. The world's a machine, the earth's a machine, animals and plants are machines, and we're machines. We're lumbering robots, in the words of Richard Dawkins. Our brains are genetically programmed computers. So we live in an unconscious world. The whole world out there, all those galaxies, all the stars are completely unconscious. It's just unconscious matter. And we happen to be conscious for reasons that are obscure. But basically, we live in an unconscious world. Whereas for a religious person in any tradition, the world is permeated by a greater consciousness than our own, to which our own consciousness is open, which we can experience through mystical experiences, and which is the background to the very existence of our own minds in the first place. That there's a greater consciousness in the universe, which in different traditions is framed and interpreted in different ways, but the reason anyone believes in God at all or any spiritual reality is through it because of experience, experiencing the presence of a greater mind or consciousness than our own. Now, how did we get to this position of an atheistic worldview that essentially creates an atheistic universe that's just a machine? Well, I'm just going to go very briefly over the history of this because it's absolutely key to understanding why we're in the situation we're in today and why all of us have been influenced by these different thoughts without necessarily knowing why or how, or not even knowing what influences have worked upon us. In the 17th century, the scientific revolution that started science as we know it was a revolution precisely because it denied what everyone had believed before. In the Middle Ages, in Christian Europe, among Christians and Jews and Muslims, the general view was that nature is alive, the earth is alive, Mother Earth, the whole universe is alive, the anima mundi, the soul of the universe, the soul of the world, permeates all things. Animals and plants are truly alive. They're organisms with souls. The very word animal comes from the Latin word anima, which means soul. So it was completely taken for granted by everybody, following the philosophy of Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas and the Arab philosophers, that we lived in a living world. The stars were intelligent beings. Each star had its own angel, its own intelligence as part of it. So when people looked at the sky, they saw a sky full of the presence of God, with every star and every planet being a living being with an intelligence of its own. The 17th century revolution said, no, that's not the way it is. The universe is made of unconscious matter, which is just like a big machine. The universe is like a clockwork machine. Stars are just made of matter like anything else. Animals and plants are not living beings with their own souls. They're machines. And human bodies are machines, too. And this was the mechanistic theory of nature. When it was first formulated by René Descartes in France, who first had this vision in 1619, Descartes made a sharp separation. He didn't deny God and angels. He said God, angels, and human spirits are immaterial. The world realm of spirit is immaterial, totally outside space and time, nothing to do with matter and nature. Nature is made of unconscious matter organized mechanically, pushed by forces in accordance with mathematical laws. The human body is a machine, and the human mind is the only thing in nature which is not mechanical. It's immaterial spirit. It shares its nature with angels and God and interacts with the machinery of the body in a small region of the brain, the pineal gland. Modern theories of Cartesian dualism are similar, except the supposed seat of interaction shifted a couple of inches into the cerebral cortex. But this theory created a duality between humans and the rest of nature. We're conscious, the rest of nature is mechanical, purely mechanical. Our bodies are mechanical too. It created a split between science and religion. Religion gets angels, God, and the human spirit and morality. Science gets the entire physical universe. And it created the famous split between mind and body. The mind and the body are two completely separate principles. That's not what anyone had believed before. So this was the dualism which enabled science and religion to go on more or less in harmony with each other, and is still the view of many scientists today who are religious. They keep them in completely separate compartments. In the 19th century, there were many people who said, two basic principles are too many. We don't want matter and spirit. There should just be one principle. So some people said, okay, there's only one thing, and that's spirit. And that's the philosophy of idealism. Everything is consciousness. Matter is sort of dumbed down mind. And that was a very popular and influential philosophy in 19th century Europe. The other school of thought were materialists. They said, no, there's no such thing as spirit, there's just matter. And that, at one stroke, got rid of angels and God. They just vanish entirely from the world picture. It leaves human minds, but then human minds are nothing but the activity of the brain. And that's the situation we're in today. This is the position held by probably 90% of academics, 95% of scientists, or at least in public. This is what they have to pretend to believe. Most medical students have to at least pretend to believe this. Most philosophers in our universities advocate this point of view. From this point of view, God is nothing but an idea in human minds. And as an idea in human minds is nothing but the activity of certain particular regions of the brain, the nervous impulses and chemical transmitters. But there's no God out there. That's a naive, childish view that science has left far behind. That's the atheist view I used to have, and that's the atheist view I encounter all the time among my scientific colleagues. But the biggest problem with this materialist worldview, which is the subject of my book, The Science Delusion, or Science Set Free, I take the 10 dogmas of the materialist so-called scientific worldview and show that each one of these assumptions, if you look at it scientifically, turns out to fall apart. They unravel as soon as you stop accepting them in a credulous, unquestioning way. And the one that I'd like to address now briefly is the idea that matter's unconscious. This was an assumption of Descartes because he split matter off from spirit, which was immaterial, and made this sharp split. The materialists get rid of the spirit and they're just left with unconscious matter. Now, as you'll immediately see, this causes a massive problem straight away, because if matter's unconscious, how come that we're conscious if the whole universe is meant to be unconscious? There's an enormous problem explaining human consciousness, and in philosophy of mind, this is called the hard problem. Because there's no known explanation for it. Matter should not be conscious, according to this theory. Philosophers of mind over the last 60 or 70 years have tied themselves in knots trying to explain away consciousness. One school of thought says, well, consciousness exists, but it's like a meaningless shadow of the activity of the brain. It doesn't do anything. You don't have free will. It doesn't actually do anything. It's just a kind of shadow, an epiphenomenon of what's happening in your brain. Another lot say it's just another way of talking about the activity of the nervous system. And as we learn enough neurophysiology, then we'll be able to get rid of what they call folk psychology, talking in terms of subjectivity and consciousness, and everything will just become a matter of describing the neurophysiology of the brain. The third school are called eliminative materialists, who say consciousness doesn't exist at all. It's an illusion. The problem is, of course, that if it's an illusion can only exist in consciousness. So it's a kind of self-contradictory position. And so these materialist philosophers attack each other because they each disagree with the other one's theories, because they're all self-contradictory or implausible, but go round and round in circles. And this is the center of the problem in consciousness studies today. Until 20 years ago, scientists ignored consciousness. When I was studying science at Cambridge, it turned up for about 10 minutes in a physiology lecture, and that was it. You know, the brain appears to be conscious. Philosophers argued about this for centuries. They've never got anywhere. So we'll leave them to waste their time on pointless arguments. We'll get on with explaining how the brain works. That was the attitude. And of course, we've understood a lot about how brains work, but it hasn't explained consciousness. A very interesting phenomenon is occurring right now. A few years ago, one of the top materialist philosophers of mind, Galen Strawson, jumped ship and stopped being a materialist. He adopted a theory called panpsychism instead. Panpsychism is the idea that there's pan means everywhere, psychism means psyche, as in mind or soul. That there's some kind of mind or soul throughout all nature. Even an electron has a kind of mind. And the idea there is that then consciousness can emerge in human brains because there are more primitive forms of consciousness in matter itself. Matter is not intrinsically unconscious or mindless. It has a kind of mind-like aspect. Interestingly, the top US philosopher of mind, Thomas Nagel, came out last year with a book adopting panpsychism. It caused shock and horror in the ranks of academic psychology and philosophy. He was viciously attacked by materialist philosophers of mind. His book is called Mind and Cosmos, subtitle, Why the Materialist Neo-Darwinian Conception of Nature is Almost Certainly False. And Nagel argues that it's incoherent to suggest that the mind can just emerge from unconscious matter. You have to have a panpsychist view. You have to have some kind of mind in nature already. He also thinks there has to be a kind of purpose in nature already, which is one of the biggest heresies in materialism, because evolution is supposed to be quite purposeless. And recently, Christoph Koch, K-O-C-H, who was Francis Crick's principal colleague in working on consciousness, came out 6 months ago in favor of panpsychism. That was a real surprise to me because he was one of the most hardline materialists that I've ever encountered. He's now come out in favor of panpsychism, and it's now spreading through the materialists. There's a kind of panic in the materialist establishment as more and more people are defecting to panpsychism. Now, panpsychism isn't a new philosophy. It's the philosophy of nature that's often called animism, the idea there's a kind of mind or spirit or soul in nature. It's found in all traditional cultures, in all shamanic cultures. It's what the Middle Ages in Europe had. Christian animism was the basis of Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas' interpretation of Aristotle. It's what the scientific revolution rejected. But it's coming back again. And it's coming back again in a very interesting, sophisticated new form. The most interesting panpsychist philosopher in the 20th century was Alfred North Whitehead, a British philosopher who taught at Harvard. And he was a mathematician as well as a philosopher. He was the first philosopher to realize the implications of quantum theory. Quantum theory says that photons and electrons and quantum particles are waves. They're not particles, just particles, not little bits of matter. People previously thought that atoms were made of little bits of matter like billiard balls. Quantum theory says, no, the fundamental reality of physical reality is wave-like. And that's the reason for the uncertainty principle in quantum theory. You can't pin down a wave to an exact place and time. Think about a wave on the sea. You can't have a wave unless it has time to wave in or space to wave in. If you reduce it to an instant, it's not a wave. So matter's made of waves, and the waves take time to wave. So what Whitehead realized right at the very beginning of the quantum revolution was this means that time is built into matter. Previously, people thought it was like little billiard balls that just persisted forever. Old-style materialism is based on a view of matter. It sees it as just persisting substance. Quantum theory reveals matter's a process. And if it's a process in time, each electron, each process in time, has a past pole and a future pole. The future pole is where it's going, the past pole is where it's come from, and it's spread out between future and past. What Whitehead argued, I think fascinatingly, is that the key to understanding the relation of mind and body is not to see them as inside and outside. That's the usual metaphor, is spatial, you know, the inner life, the outer world. The relation of mind and body is the relation in time. The mind is the future pole, the body is the past pole. The mind is concerned with possibilities. Our minds are filled with possibilities. Consciousness is a field of possibility, and its main function is to choose among possible actions. So our minds are filled with virtual futures, virtual possibilities. As soon as we make a choice and put it into action, then it becomes a physical fact, but by then it's in the past. Every one of us decided to come here this evening, and it's a measurable fact that we're in this room. But there was a time in the past when we were deciding among different things we could have done this evening. We could have done something else. We could have come here. Once we decided to come here and did it, it becomes a physical fact. But before we did it, it was something in the future, one of other possibilities in the future among which we chose. And consciousness is, as it were, the realm of possibilities, virtual futures. Now, even electrons have something like that. The Schrödinger wave equation in quantum mechanics is an equation that tells you all the things an electron can do. As soon as an electron starts moving, the wave equation describes all its possible actions. It describes all possible actions that electron could perform. And as soon as the electron interacts with something, collides with an atom or something, or a photographic film, those possibilities collapse down to the one thing that actually happens. This is sometimes called the collapse of the wave function. But as soon as that happens, it's in the past. And a new set of future possibilities opens up. These future possibilities are not physical facts. Possibilities are not physical. They're mental. They're to do with possible futures. And until they've happened, you can't measure them. But when they've happened, they're not a possibility anymore. They're a fact. So this idea of Whiteheads applies even to electrons as well as to humans, and I think is the best way of conceiving panpsychism. The role of the mind in any self-organizing system is what gives the system its goals, its possibilities, and insofar as there's an element of choice, then the consciousness, if there's any consciousness involved, then that's what it's doing, choosing among possible actions. Now, most activity, including most of our own activity, is habitual. We don't need to choose most of the time because we follow habits. But insofar as we're making choices among possibilities, that's where consciousness comes in. Well, this was Whitehead's theory, and I think it makes the most sense of what's happening. The interesting thing is, you see, that it shows that any self-organizing system would have this mental pole as well as a physical pole. Most discussion of panpsychism concerns electrons. Now, it's hard to get excited about the mental life of an electron, but the whole thing becomes much more interesting when we think about big self-organizing systems. And the one I like thinking about most is the sun. The sun is a self-organizing system. In fact, the whole solar system is a self-organizing system. Now, if the sun has a body, which it certainly does, what about the mind of the sun? Can the sun think? Well, from this point of view, the answer is yes. The sun's very probably conscious. Now, as soon as you say that, you realize this is violating one of the most basic taboos of materialism: matter is unconscious. Anyone who thinks the sun's conscious is stupid or childlike. Every human culture treats the sun as if it's conscious in some way. It's a god or a goddess, or there's, you know, in Hinduism it's Surya, the sun god. In Japanese mythology, it's a goddess. The sun is treated as conscious in all cultures, and for the Greeks it was Apollo, it was a god of the sun. And is treated as conscious by children. When children draw the sun, they draw it with a smiley face. So you see, precisely because all of us thought it when we were children, we're now told as grown-ups, that's so stupid, that's just childish thinking, primitive people think that way, childish people think that's... We now know the sun is just a giant hydrogen bomb. But actually we don't now know that. No one in science has ever discussed it even, let alone thought about how you might test it. It's simply an assumption. Matter is unconscious. Descartes said so in 1630. Matter is unconscious, therefore the sun's unconscious. That's the basis of this widespread belief the sun's unconscious. It's a superstition of materialism to treat it as unconscious. I'm not saying I can prove it's conscious, but I'm saying it's an open question. I can't prove it's conscious, but you can't prove it's unconscious. So it's an open question, and I think it's very likely the sun is conscious, and if the sun is, then what about the stars? All of them would be like the sun. Then what about the galaxy? The stars in our galaxy, the Milky Way that we can see so clearly from here over Cortez Island, the Milky Way is billions of stars, but the Milky Way is like a giant organism, and they're like cells in the body of this galaxy. What if the whole galaxy is conscious? Why not? I think it very probably is. Then what if the entire cosmos is conscious? Why not? And then from panpsychism, you see, we get the idea of perhaps a cosmic consciousness. But then, is that the same as God, or is it pantheism? We're then into a kind of almost theological and philosophical discussion. What would be the difference between God and pantheism? Pantheism would be the consciousness of nature as it is. The mind of God would be a mind that transcends nature, which is within nature and also transcends nature. Like our own minds are within our bodies, but they also transcend them. Our body is here in the present. Our mind extends into the future through our hopes, plans, dreams, our aspirations. It extends into the past through our memories. Our minds transcend our physical bodies through time, and they transcend them through space. As I've talked here in this very lodge before, I think our minds extend far beyond our brains. When you see me now, your image of me isn't inside your head, as scientific dogma says it is. It's where it seems to be. It's outside your head. Our minds are extended around us all the time, which is why people can feel when they're being stared at, and why people can pick up intentions, as in telepathy, why dogs can pick up intentions, as in dogs that know when their owners are coming home, picking up their owners' intentions from far away. So I think our minds transcend our bodies, and I think that the mind of the whole cosmos may transcend the cosmos. Now, this is where we get back to traditional ideas about the nature of the divine mind or the nature of God. And in all the major traditions, there's an astonishing measure of agreement about the nature of God's mind. There's a book that I'm very keen on that came out recently by an American theologian called The Experience of God, Being, Consciousness, Bliss by David Bentley Hart, H-A-R-T. And he shows very clearly that in different traditions there are such similar views. In the Advaitic tradition in Hinduism, for example, the name for the ultimate nature of God's mind is Sat Chit Ananda. Sat means being, Chit means knowledge, Ananda means joy or bliss. In the Christian tradition, the nature of God is the Holy Trinity. God is not, of course, an old man with a white beard. I mean, that's incredibly... I mean, the kind of God most atheists don't believe in is the kind of God most theists don't believe in either. God is the Holy Trinity, according to traditional Christian teaching. God the Father is the source of all being. And God sustains doesn't just create the world in the beginning like a kind of demiurge fashioning something out of clay or an engineer making it out of atoms or something. God is the ground of being now. The fact anything exists right now is because it's sustained all the time by God's being. God is the logos, or consciousness, of all things, the form of all things, the basis of all reason and all knowledge in the universe, human and divine, and animal. And God's nature is bliss or joy. The nature of God's consciousness is to be blissful or joyful. And the traditional understanding is that our minds are reflections, or everything in nature has some aspect of this divine being, kind of scaled down versions, fractals, scaled down versions of God's being in all creation. And that our minds are capable of linking to the mind of God through direct experience. And that's why anyone has ever believed in God. It's not a matter of assenting to some ridiculous set of beliefs. It's a matter of experience, primarily, of being in a presence greater than one's own. And this can happen in nature. It happens to me quite often on Cortes Island. If I'm sitting quietly in the forest or on the beach, I often have a sense of presence, a sense of presence, much greater sense of being or consciousness than just me. Sometimes in music, sometimes in art, sometimes in beautiful church services, sometimes in prayer, sometimes in meditation. Many people have a flavor, a taste of being in a mind greater than their own. I don't know how many people, actually, perhaps I can try an experiment I've never done before right now and see how many people have had some experience of being in a greater presence than their own. Because some people are embarrassed by this, perhaps if you all close your eyes, I'll keep mine open and I'll report back to you later. If you close your eyes, if you've ever had a sense of being in a greater presence or spirit of being. Well, thank you. I can reveal that about 90 to 95% of people here put their hands up. So we may mean different things by that, but you see, I think that this is a primary part of our being human, this greater presence within which we live. And this has many implications. While I've been here on Cortes Island, I've been reading one of the greatest of the Christian philosophers, St. Anselm, who was writing around 1100 AD. And St. Anselm is writing about the mind of God, the nature of God. And he says that the mind of God must contain all qualities. Every fragrance that you can smell is a fragrance in the mind of God. So if you smell the fragrance of rose, then the smell of roses in the mind of God. All conceivable smells are within the mind of God, all conceivable qualities. God's mind is a mind of infinite possibility. What I'm thinking about at the moment is how this applies to biological evolution. Because the normal theory is that something like a flower, these beautiful flowers in Hollyhock Garden, they evolved, they've been bred, of course, some of them by plant breeders, but flowers have been around for 70 million years, long before humans existed on the Earth. And the flower is a kind of dialogue between the plant and the animal realms. As Darwin once said, there could have been no flower before there was an eye to see it. They're an interaction of animals and plants, and they depend on eyes, particularly the eyes of insects, bees, butterflies, moths, hummingbirds as well. But the flowers have evolved with those colours, those forms, those symmetries, those patterns and those smells long before humans appeared. And the normal biological theory would be that, a bee, in a primitive bee, a random mutation produced neurotransmitters and nerve cells that led the bee to see or to have a subjective experience of a particular colour or to react as if it had a subjective experience, although it probably doesn't. And it's just kind of random selection that triggers off advantageous biological responses. So if a bee does have subjective experience, it would have to be sort of invented by each insect, you know, each kind of insect with it, which has qualities. But if there's a source of all qualities in the mind of God, it's a more economical theory, in my view, that animals tune in to these qualities in the mind of God. Now, I hesitate to bring into a public arena a new idea that I've only had a few weeks. I'll mention it, I'll see how this goes over. This is an experiment too. If the mind of God contains an infinite source of bliss, then if we're thinking about the nature of blissful human experiences, and I thought, why not think in terms of one of the most attractive of all blissful experiences, namely the orgasm, how would that relate to the mind of God? Well, The standard theory would say, well, it's evolved to serve reproductive physiology and because of short circuits in the brain or neurotransmitters or serotonin release or something in the thalamus or the limbic system or wherever. Well, that may be true. It probably is. But it doesn't explain the subjective experience. And so that's not explained at all by anything in mechanistic science. What if, at the moment of orgasm, there isn't a kind of opening, temporary opening of a kind of window into the divine bliss? Then we're drawn towards the mind of God. The mind of God attracts us through not just orgasms, but any pleasurable or attractive phenomenon. Ultimately, these are connections with the mind of God. I think that the interesting thing about this, you see, is traditional theologies in the West and elsewhere, and indeed in Greek philosophy, God works in the world according to Aristotle, which is pre-Christian, of course, and according to Christian theologies, and according to other theologies, by being attractive. God doesn't push the world from behind like a steam engine. God pulls the world from the future. We're attracted, we're drawn towards the divine. God is the prime mover of the universe in the medieval cosmology, not by pushing it, but by pulling it. The whole universe is striving to get closer to God. And how this reflects itself in human life is the otherwise inexplicable strivings that humans have for truth and beauty and goodness. And these have propelled human beings, or drawn human beings, for a very long time. This precedes Christianity, of course. And interestingly, even some of my atheist colleagues, the reason they don't believe in the kind of God they've rejected is because they believe in truth. And they think truth is the most important goal. Well, I do too. But the fact they're so drawn to truth to such a position that they become, some of them, fanatical atheists. They do so because of a devotion to truth. It's a kind of unconscious devotion to this divine principle. Some people are irresistibly drawn to beauty. We all are, to some degree, and so are animals. When you hear beautiful bird song, when you look at the way animals are drawn to flowers and to fruits. And again, one can see that as being drawn by the divine. And goodness, being drawn towards selfless service, to being drawn towards doing the right thing, again, is a basic human need. We find it in all societies, various forms of altruism, which go way beyond the needs of just surviving yourself or helping your kids to survive. There's a kind of drive seen and recognized in all human cultures of a pull towards goodness. Now, I think these are ways in which the divine mind works in our lives, whether we're aware of it or not. And of course, we can cut ourselves off from this divine mind, and we can deny it exists. I now see atheism as a terrible self-deprivation of atheists. I mean, in the name of truth, that's their devotion to a higher good, which is a higher good, by rejecting a totally inadequate image of God, a God who just fills in gaps that science can't explain, or who starts off the world machine in the first place with the Big Bang, or who fine-tunes the laws and constants of nature. By rejecting a completely inadequate view of God, they end up with a view of the universe that's totally unconscious, that has no purpose in it, that humans have no purpose, there's no purpose beyond just living as well as with as much pleasure as you can, and maybe subscribing to some higher ideals, because there's always an unconscious drive towards the divine, even in atheists, and that's what gives them their nobility, because many of them are noble. But it closes down the ways in which we can communicate with the divine, where we can be open to God's spirit, which can inspire and guide us. And in the end, it's bad for your health. So studies have shown in the United States that people who have religious belief or practice live longer and are healthier and recover from diseases better than those that don't. For white males, it's about 5 years. For black males, it's about 15 years extension of life. Now, if any pill were known to do that, it would be hailed a medical breakthrough. And yet, these are well-established statistics. There's well-established statistics that prayer and meditation help people's health. And I think that's because they provide channels or connections with what is the medium in which we live and move and have our being, to quote St. Paul. This vision of God is the vision of God that's the religion that all religions have had, is a God in whom we live and move and have our being, and who's the source of our conscious life, and to whom our minds are linked, and from whom our minds are derived. Well, this is for me the way in which I pursue this through prayer and meditation in my own life, and through experiences of the divine through nature on Cortes Island, and through beauty and through love. And for each one of us, we all have our own ways of doing this. I, for myself, find practicing the Christian religion a great help. It's my tradition. I'm not saying it's the only one for everybody, but I think for those who've come from Christian backgrounds or from Jewish backgrounds, it's the religion of one's ancestors is the most natural one to follow. It's not the only one. You can switch, and many people have. But it's at least worth considering as a first or second option, instead of not considering at all, as I did myself for many years. I think then that coming back to where we began, this is part of what I think is a more general movement going on in the world today of anatheism, finding God again. Thank you. Thank you.